Hello, my name is Guy Somerset. I'm the books and culture editor of The Listener, and welcome to the latest of our Listener Book Club podcast discussions. This week with three books rather than the usual one. We're doing the fiction finalists for the New Zealand Post Book Awards, Sue Orr's From Under That Overcoat, Fiona Kidman's The Trouble with Fire, and Rangatira by Paula Morris. With me to discuss the books, we have our usual array of people. Normally we have all booksellers. This week we have one current bookseller, Tilly Lloyd of Unity Books in Wellington, one former bookseller, Graham Beattie, better known these days, of course, for his Beattie's book blog, and finally, someone who I don't think has ever been a bookseller, Jane Westaway, never been a bookseller,
no.
I don't think. Jane is a writer and the co-editor of New Zealand Books, the quarterly magazine still, Jane?
Yes, Quarterly Review.
Very, very good. Excellent magazine. Thoroughly recommended. Now, to begin the discussion, I just wanted to read a little bit from something Michael Cunningham wrote the other day. He was one of the judges for the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, which was notoriously not awarded this year, not through any reason of his, as a very long piece that he wrote last week in The New Yorker made clear. One of the things he said in that piece, which struck me as being highly pertinent to our book awards, was the following. If novels or short story collections could be weighed strictly in terms of their components, fully developed characters, check, original voice, check, solidly crafted structure, check, serious theme, check, they might satisfy, but they would fail to enchant. A great work of fiction involves a certain frisson that occurs when its various components cohere and then ignite. The cause of the fire should, to some extent, elude the expert's sense to investigate. The three books here, the three finalists for the New Zealand Post Book Awards, are these books that have that wow factor, do we think? Graham?
I think wow factor is probably overstating it a little, Guy. I mean, one of the things in the US, there's something like 600 or 700 novels published every year and 200 or 300 collections of short stories, and they've got a huge choice from well-established and new writers. I mean, we're talking about a much smaller group, and I doubt whether you could actually say that there's great fiction or fiction of the wow factor frequently published. I mean, all three of these books, I think, are quite outstanding in their own way, but I don't know that I'd actually say they've got the wow factor.
Tilly?
Well, yes, I agree with what Graham said in the context of our island. So, yes, they have it. Our judges have shortlisted them. That's what we've got on the plate. Some years have given us books that are total standouts, but most years give us the same issue where you've got three which have a similar layer of merit, and that's just the reality of our size, I think.
Jane, what do you think on that?
Yeah, I totally agree. I love that passage that you read. In fact, I cut and pasted it. I thought it was so great. And I love the way that the cause of the fire imagery in relating to Fiona Kidman's
yes.
stories. But I think it's right. We can't possibly expect in a pool this small to come out with great new books. And the way Cunningham defines that is more or less by definition it doesn't resemble the great books of the past. Well, I don't think I could honestly say that about any of these three, or quite possibly any of the books that crop up on a regular basis. We're just too small.
But even within that context of what we have out there, what we have published in the past year, there's the perennial argument, you know, some people say, in fact Fiona Kidman I think said, and the judges themselves said that there were, you know, they could have had five on this short list rather than the three. For you, any of you, were there other books that you could have seen happily either making up a five or indeed usurping the three that were here in the first place? Graham?
Yeah, well, certainly I would, I'm a five man, and of course these are awards, there used to be five shortlists each year until a couple of years ago when they had a complete overhaul of the awards, and sadly I think they, in separating the fiction and the poetry, which I think had to be done, it was quite unfair before you had fiction up against verse, well that's an impossible situation, but to reduce it to three I think is a great shame, and if I'd had five, assuming that these three are in, the two standout books missing for me are The Conductor by Sarah Quigley and The Larnacs by Owen Marshall. And it's interesting that had those been in, then all three of the novels, that's those two plus Rangatira, are historical novels. They're based on fact, they're based on real people and places and events where the novelist has taken that and then used their own imagination to fill in all the gaps. So I'd have those three and then these two collections of short stories, which are both largely contemporary.
And Jane, were there other books that you would have seen on
that? I was surprised the Larnacs weren't. Wasn't there. I'm not sure about Quigley because there's so much behind the drawing up of these shortlists that is not necessarily to do totally with the value of the literature in the book. And I wonder if it's the setting of the conductor meant that it somehow ruled itself out in some way. Is it a New Zealand book? I suppose I'm thinking about the parameters we have on the books we review where you have to have two hits out of three, New Zealand content, New Zealand author, New Zealand publisher. And if you don't get two hits, I'm sorry, we can't review you because we've got too much else to do. And I wonder if, although it might be informal and unspoken, if that's come into the decision here too.
Tilly, what about you? Were there any other books that you would have liked to have seen there?
Oh, yes, I feel the same. I feel the conductor needed to be there. But there were others as well. I mean, why couldn't Hamish Clayton's Wolf have been up there too? He got, you know, the Best First Book Award. He could easily have been in there, and so could have Catastrophe, the Ian Wedi, which I just adored.
I agree completely with Wolf. I think it's stronger, frankly, than any of the three that are there, and I think it does have, obviously not to the same extent that Michael Cunningham's talking about, but it does have that, wow factor. It's doing something a bit more. And I'd also put in a word for Tim Wilson's The Desolation Angel, which I think is a far stronger short story collection than the Sue Orr one, I would have seen in there. It did to me, I must say, it felt a rather timid shortlist, and it did feel a bit box ticking, you know. Everything is a very solid shortlist, but there wasn't anybody kind of taking any risks in there. Would that be fair, do you think?
Yeah. Well, it's tricky, you know. I mean, I've been a judge in those awards under previous guises a couple of times, and I've judged other awards, international and so on. And you've got five judges in this case, I think. You know, you've got five people picking three books, and they've got a list of all the names that collectively we've just mentioned, and you're argy-bargy arguing backwards and forwards and some people like this. And, of course, the whole thing is pretty largely subjective. So, you know, it's just one of those things. I think each year there are controversies about books that have been included or excluded, and I think it'll always be the way, and it's probably part of the fun of the Book Awards, but it's one of the reasons, another reason why there should be five on the shortlist rather than three.
I don't agree with that, Graham.
You've spoken about this. Now, Jane, you've spoken about this before. I know, Jane, that you think it's very easy to get down to three.
I think it's not easy to get down to three. It's and it's easier to get to five. And I think that one of the reasons, I mean, maybe it's a justification for having a long list that we don't always have every year a book with the wow factor. And it's very easy to rank a good clutch that are more or less equal. And I think we could go on extending the short list because there are so many that reach the same level. But what we so often lack is one good standout. But can I just say, the book that I don't feel strongly, really, that anything was particularly missing this year, as much as I felt last year that Patrick Evans' Gifted was missing. That felt to me like an appalling oversight.
Wasn't that eligible the previous year?
Well, whenever it was, sorry.
Mm. Yes. Oh, whenever I couldn't agree with you more.
Most dreadful omission. What an important book in so many ways. I mean, not just because of content, but because of the quality of the writing. It was lovely. But for me, there's nothing really standing out quite to that extent this year.
Before we get into the three that we do have, just a quick question to the one existing bookseller that we have, Tilly. I just want to take advantage of that. It seems to me this year, more than any year, despite all the efforts of the organisers, that there seems to be almost no conversation or interest in the awards at all. We've tried to prompt it on our website, and there's not been a huge amount of feedback there. I'm just wondering, on the front line there, Tilly, are people interested in these awards? What's happening with the sales of these books?
Yes, they are interested, and yes, you'll be reassured to know there is talk on the floor. It just might not be that the online chat isn't quite where it's at for this. I'm not sure if it's just been spread out too wide by choosing three books. You know, the shortlist.
probably
may have made a difference.
In terms of the sales, which ones are selling, both in the fiction shortlist and more generally?
Oh, The Conductor has outsold them all.
Oh, really?
Oh, God, yeah, by a long shot. By a long shot.
Yeah, but of the ones that we have, which ones are doing well?
All three are doing fine.
Oh, very diplomatic.
No, it's true, though. They are all doing fine. They're all abreast of each other. All booksellers will have good stock of those three fiction titles.
Okay.
And, I mean, it's really important. I love the way Michael Cunningham wrote about not just the process of the judging, and I do empathise with the judges that are dealing with it this year, but he also wrote about the job of it, you know, to bring more serious attention to work by awarding it the main prize. And I think each of these three fictions needs more serious attention. I'd love it if much more people were reading them. I don't care if they buy them, but I'd just love it if they were reading them.
Right, let's get into them. There's three of them. We'll start with Sue Orr. From Under the Overcoat, a collection of short stories, all of which riff in some way or another on a previous classic short story, which is I've used the word audacious, and I used it to her, and she gets not defensive, but, you know, she says that she's not pretending for a moment that she's trying to set herself alongside these writers, although I must say I find it very hard not to compare when you're reading. What did you make of that collection, Jane?
I'd like you. I mean, I have to say, bold, audacious, good on her for trying, but to me it still comes down to, what have we actually got in front of us? You know, the book itself, the stories themselves. You can't judge a book by what it's harking back to. And a lot of people won't have read all the stories. I haven't read all the stories she's referring to. And finally, you've got the stories themselves. And I think when I look at the stories themselves, though I found them well written and often entertaining and really various too, which I liked, but to me it's not an ordinary short story. It's just not a standout for me.
It struck me that they're very solid, as you say, very solidly written, but there's not a lot of stylistic or even imaginative flair to them, which I think is interesting in comparison to her previous collection of short stories, where there were one or two, three or four, in fact, in that really did demonstrate both those things. But with these, they did feel just much more journeyman-like, I thought. What did you think, Tilly?
Well, I wouldn't say journeyman-like. I thought I was actually very impressed with these. I read these back in February last year, which is when the book was released, and then again now. I think there is some really, really exciting work in here, and I know some reviewers found that it was a bit pretentious, but I didn't find that at all. I just thought, oh, well, this is cross-referencing, there's heaps of guts in these stories, there is ample evidence of really good writing. So I felt it did have a spark, actually. Really good spark.
Graham.
Jane. I just wanted to say I agree with Tilly. I didn't find it pretentious at all. I've read far more pretentious story collections. This is not pretentious. It's quite gutsy, like Tilly said.
Graham?
Well, it's interesting because I read the introduction, and I could only recall about four of the stories of these, classic short stories, we call them that. And so I decided to just read them one after the other without looking again at the front of the book to see who she had used as a model, as it were, the previous writer. And I read them in that way. And apart from the James Joyce one, I honestly had no idea. I mean, I'm not an academic or a scholar in this area, but I had no idea. I'd forgotten who they were meant to relate back to, and so I just enjoyed them as a collection of short stories. Then I went back and read the introduction, whatever, again, when she took them, and I thought, actually, the introduction in itself is a great piece of writing, and a great introduction to the short story and The Overcoat and so on. I'd never heard of The Overcoat before, and the publishers and the author have kindly, for us, put the original story of The Overcoat in at the back of the book. I know, I like them as a group of short stories, and I think it was probably in the Listener, someone said, anyway, that her previous journalistic experience comes through, and, you know, and that she's got stylistic restraints and so on, perhaps. But I enjoy them as a collection.
Okay. Let's move on to Paula Morris's novel, the one novel in the shortlist, Rangatira, which is about one of her forebearers, the Rangatira, or Maori chief Paratene Tamanu, and the him and the fellow Maori chiefs who all went to England on a tour in the 19th century. Interesting here that there are a number of themes from this that kind of dovetail with Wolf, which we mentioned before, the Hamish Clayton novel, about the kind of unreliability of people's memories and people's interpretation, and how that can kind of affect what's perceived and what we hear about further down in history. Graham, what did you think of this?
Well, I have to say I really enjoyed this. I mean, it's reported that, you know, Paula Morris on and off has spent about 9 years researching this. And as you said, it's about her forebear Paratene Tamanu. And it's one of those things where it shows she's, and in fact, if you read the acknowledgements at the back of the book, she acknowledges a huge number of people and institutions where she's been to get information and material and so on, and help in her research by her husband as well. And so she's got the whole sort of thing together, as much as can be proven, written down, recorded at the time, and then she's used her own imagination and her own very, very good and appealing writing style to link the whole thing together. And I think it's a really, fine piece of fiction. I mean, it's like the other two novels I mentioned before, The Conductor and The Larynx. They've done the same thing. They've done all the research into the background and then filled in the gaps. But it's their own writing ability in particular that makes it so readable. And the other great thing about this book is the cover. I mean, it's the original Gottfried Lindauer painting of Paratene Tamanu, which is in the Auckland City Gallery. And it's just a fabulous looking book. Penguin have done a nice job of publishing it, I think, designing it.
And it's a useful reference point because she talks obviously about the painting of that picture and some of the comments that are made about it during the book. You can kind of cross-refer to the cover and find out the extent to which that's true. The research that you mentioned there, obviously a lot of it, it struck me that in places a little heavily worn. Jane, what did you think?
I thought the book had a lot of pluses. I think the voice is very attractive and the writing is good. I hate to say it's a very nice read, but, you know, that's shorthand. and I also really like the way she struck a nice balance between 19th century speech and modern speech. I mean, some people trying to do that would go over the top, either go too idiomatic for the 21st century or too twee for the past, and I think she does that very nicely. And I think the historical aspect is interesting. You can hear the but coming, can't you? It didn't enchant me. And I think if I had to name one thing that stopped it enchanting me, it was the fact that the story was, I was going to say bookended. Well, it's not, because the Lindauer and the Lindauer sections come in on and off all the way through. But for me, there wasn't enough at stake. You know that in some sense he's going to be all right and not all right even before you set out on the voyage. And when they get to England, to me, it's too mediated by the voice looking back. I wanted to be on that voyage right from the beginning and not know what was going to happen.
I agree, and I think that the voice, as a written voice, because this is Paratene writing rather than speaking about what's happened on the trip, struck me as slightly too cautious a voice, and it felt too careful and formal, the narration of the novel. It didn't kind of... her imagination was never kind of let loose in the way that one would have hoped.
No, that's what I longed for, because the writing is lovely and the voyages are so interesting, and what happened in London is interesting, but what happens when they're in London, it's actually quite a thin story. There's not a lot. And so I felt that she needed to pump up the tension just a tiny bit. And one way to have done that was to have been to somehow, well, just not to begin with the man looking back, but for us to have gone right in there with him at the time it happened.
Tilly, what did you make of it?
Well, I agree somewhat with what you're saying. And I feel that some of what's happened for the author is the same thing that happens with Anne Salmond for the cannibal dog, and also now for Bly, and that is that it's not so much an intrusion of the research, it's a lack of momentum of using it. And so I think the structure of this novel is fantastic, to do the 3 days with Lindauer and also then the reminiscing, the journal keeping of Paratini himself, followed by the little pieces from the Bible. So it sort of runs like that all the way through, doesn't it? I felt that it was the most amazing work, but that it lost some momentum in those endless, insufferable meetings that they had to do. Now, those were endless, insufferable meetings for the, you know, for the people attending them, for the Maori who were on exhibition, so to speak. And it was a really important theme that the post-treaty Maori were exhibits, in the same way that this portrait later would be an exhibit. And the other themes of battles, that, you know, words replacing guns, so he's writing this for us, and other themes like the contract, their contract with Wesley, the ratbag minister, and also the contracts with the Crown, you know, the fighting over the land, or at least the negotiations, which of course we still haven't seen the end of and no doubt never will, which is fine with me. But I think it's a really, really important novel, and that she has done this fantastic job, except for the slumpy bits in the middle. Well, I don't know about you four, you three, but I've never read a perfect novel. So I don't think this is a very big fault.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, and that's a point that Michael Cunningham makes, isn't it? That, in fact, you know, if you were to award a prize to the perfect novel, you would probably not have the most readable and the best novel of the year. You would just have something that had indeed had ticked all those boxes. So, yes.
He says it's a long-established, impossible project. The attempt to name a best book as if books were cucumbers at a county fair.
Yes.
Lovely.
That was great.
The kind of A&P show school of prize giving, to which, perhaps appropriately or not, probably very popular with A&P goers, Fiona Kidman, The Trouble with Fire, her collection of short stories, all of which in some way or another involve the theme of fire, which is one of the pluses for it for me. Other pluses for it for you, Jane?
Yes, definitely pluses. I particularly like the nostalgia-laden stories, because it's not mawkish nostalgia. It the periods that she's writing about back in the past obviously exert a strong hold over her, and that hold was transferred to me. So I quite enjoy well-written nostalgia because it packs an emotional punch, which is what one wants. And she's so good at that old farming life and the grimness of it and so on. The less successful stories for me were the ones more set in the present. They fit about smart people. There was something that didn't quite ring true for me about them.
She does seem to have a wonderfully romantic idea of Wellington, which is full of people who go to the opera and people who work in, you know, diplomacy, you know, in the foreign service or whatever.
Who are these people?
I know, it's a very, very glamorous life that she depicts there, but I've yet to meet all those people, I must admit, in my Wellington day-to-day existence.
I really loved the linked stories in the, was it the second part? The two or three generations, I thought that was terrific. I really enjoyed that. And yes, of course, it's kind of, that kind of sweeps, reminiscent of Munro and a few other people, and also has a lot to say about this society, this culture, though it says it's small. But as I say, I didn't like the more modern ones.
She doesn't seem very good when she strays from her own social milieu, really, does she?
I mean,
there's a terrible moment where in the story, the history of it, at the end of the history of it, where a mugger and a mugger's mum are brought in, and she doesn't seem as comfortable in that kind of social setting as she is with the more middle-class settings, which she gets spot on.
No, I agree. The historical two historical fictions at the end are interesting, aren't they?
Yes.
With Gordon Coates and Lady Barker. I think on the whole I preferred the Gordon Coates one. I thought that was terrific.
I mean, from what... Sorry.
Go on.
Well, I was just going to say, from what you've been saying and what we've been talking about, I mean, you know, it's worth pointing out, you know, a considerable amount of variety in these stories as well.
There is.
Tilly, what did you make of it?
Well, Fiona's just so experienced, and it just so shows, and there's nothing rushed, and everything's developed, and there's great clarity. So I always thought, I always feel in completely safe hands when I'm reading Fiona's work.
For the most part, I agree there, but there were a couple, I felt, of strange plot lurches. In a couple of the stories, it seems that if you have an abortion or have a baby, you suddenly run off at the drop of a hat with a completely inappropriate man. I mean, that seemed... Both of those seems...
I don't think so.
They didn't seem set up enough and established enough to be convincing, those two moments, I felt, in those two stories.
I found it convincing.
I found that convincing. The one I really did not find convincing was the dead woman's dress.
Right.
That one just left me cold. I thought, oh no, don't do that. It was not convincing to me.
And the family there did occasionally, I felt, veer into the stock villain territory with the, you know, the wicked stepfather and stepmother and stepsister. I felt that weren't quite nuanced enough in the drawing.
Mm. It's New Zealand rural Gothic.
True.
Not as funny as Ronald Hugh Morrison.
Graham, what did you make of this collection?
Well, generally, I think, you know, it's a lovely collection. As Tilly said, Fiona is one of our senior contemporary writers. She's been writing for 50 years, I think I read somewhere. And I agree, too, with Jane about that middle section. It's the book's divided into three parts, and there are, I think, 11 stories in total, and it runs to 300 pages. None of them are especially long. I mean, you're talking about 20, 30 pages short stories. I thought some of them were really outstanding. I thought the middle section, those link stories, could well have been a novel, you know.
I did too.
Amazing that an author would go to so much trouble to construct, you know, three short stories when the potential for an entire book, I thought, but just generally, you know, a nice collection. And I must say, you know, it's rather good for New Zealand's famous as producers of short stories, you know, going back, of course, to Catherine Mansfield and Frank Sargeson, but there have been loads, and there are loads of contemporary, really good contemporary short story writers. So it's nice, surprising, but nice to see in a shortlist of three, two collections of short stories.
And I'd just like to give a shout-out to one of the stories, Preservation, which just has the most wonderful idea, the idea of somebody using borrowing a wedding dress and then putting somebody's corpse in it and then sending it back to the shop.
But that just didn't work for me,
Did it not? I mean, the imaginative flair that I missed elsewhere. You know, not in this collection, which I thought was a very good collection.
Well, I like it, up to the point that it turned out somebody else had worn it.
Well, that was brilliant. That's the brilliance of it. A great idea. I mean, you know, where do you get that idea? That's a brilliant idea, I thought.
What did we think about the one set in Hanoi?
I like that too. And that, I must admit, I immediately assumed, this is very autobiographical, because there are autobiographical elements in that.
But
in the acknowledgements, she talks about having to do quite a lot of research about Vietnam, so I'm not, I don't think that is a, you know, not a straight account of anything.
If it was a straight account, it doesn't undercut the fact that it's fairly powerful.
Well, it is, it's incredibly well.
And I spent 8 weeks in Hanoi on one occasion, and it really resonated with me, that story. That's well done, well crafted, kept me gripped. I was really interested to read it right through. It's a great piece of storytelling.
Okay, right. Unfortunately, time is coming up for us, so I'm going to do the horrible thing now and make you all choose one book from the three. You've all done it before as judges previously of National Book Awards, so probably under rather more onerous circumstances than this. I'll start with, I'll go first. I'm going to say Fiona Kidman. Graham?
I'm going to say Paula Morris.
Tilly?
Yes, it's Rangatira.
And Jane?
Oh, I suspect Paula will win. Is that good enough an answer?
Well, that's not a real answer, is it?
Oh, God. All right, Paula.
Okay, well, there you go.
But Fiona are a terribly close second, so I don't know.
Okay, well, I don't know if any of you are going to the awards. I am, so I'm going to be dodging all these authors after the last half hour. Hopefully they'll forgive me. Thank you all for taking part. Good of you. Three books this month rather than the one. Next month we're back with David Ballantyne's Sydney Bridge Upside Down, which is a great 1968 novel which has just been reissued by Text Classics. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next month. Or you'll hear us.